Are you not shamed that you care so much about accumulating money, honors, and reputation with so little concern about wisdom, truth, and the improvement of your soul, right? It's very easy, especially, you know, when we're idealistic young people protected in a college environment, to be like, yes, obviously that's what matters, right? That's the kind of person I want to be. But how we act in different situations demonstrates whether we are actually affirming that value or not.
Welcome to Stoa Conversations. My name is Caleb Ontiveros, and in this conversation, I speak with Professor Marcus Hidal. Marcus is a philosophy professor at the U.S. Naval Academy and a return guest. You should be sure to check out episodes 14 and 50, where we talk about happiness and handling others, non-stoic behavior. Today, we're going to be talking about issues that arise with the mind-body connection. But before that, I should always, you know, welcome you back. Thanks for being up to chat again.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me, Caleb. I always love these discussions and learn a lot and enjoy thinking through some of these issues.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we were ping-ponging a few different possible discussion topics for our conversation. We settled on this issue surrounding the mind-body connection. So there's been a lot of new work establishing what the mind-body connection amounts to, how to think about how our environment, our body, different aspects of our body, of course, influence how we think, and the reverse. And I think there's an open question, you know, what do Stoics today do with this information? So we're going to dive into some of the potential problems, potential upshots with the mind-body connection. And just go from there, see what we stumble into. I think this is an area both Marcus and I are actively thinking about, you know, how do you make sense of Stoicism today with current beliefs, with current findings about things like the mind-body connection?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I like to think about this. So Lawrence Becker has a book called A New Stoicism, where he considers thinking about how Stoicism, we can take the tenets of Stoicism and think about them in a modern world. And he starts the book relatively early on. He has this great quote where he says, it would be interesting to try to imagine what would happen if Stoicism had a continuous 2,300-year history. If Stoics had to confront Bacon and Descartes, Newton and Locke, Hobbes and Bentham, Hume and Kant, Darwin and Marx, and the vicissitudes of ethics of the 20th century. It's reasonable to suppose that Stoics would have found a way to address the false elements of the doctrine when the scientific consensus did. They would have found ways to hold their own distinct view, even as it changed to remain plausible given the best scientific knowledge about the world. And so it's interesting for those like you and I, Caleb, who find something admirable about Stoicism, something more than just intellectually interesting, something that we think ought to guide our lives in some ways, to think about how, if at all, a philosophy that was at its fullest, at its richest, you know, 2,000 years ago, would have to adapt if we accept certain scientific things as the most likely candidates that are out there. And so I think the mind-body problem is a subset of those issues. Becker actually talks about it as one of the issues that he thinks a modern Stoicism, a new Stoicism would have to embrace. And that seems true to me as well. I'm not sure if I would arrive at quite the same place he does, but I do think that we would have to change in some minor ways Stoicism to make sense of that. And I think it can still be distinctly Stoic nonetheless.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think let's walk through different ways of stating the mind-body connection or mind-body problem and see where that takes us. So I think first, you could think of as its weakest form, perhaps you have what you might call the influence thesis. There's this idea that the body influences and shapes our minds. And here by body, of course, we just mean our organism. And there are different ways to sketch out what influence looks like. But I think at this level of detail, the problem is not so much a challenge for Stoic philosophy as something that, you know, a fact that one should keep in mind when one is aiming to be a good Stoic, as it were. So just to do a little quick blurb about Stoic psychology, according to the Stoics, you know, you're always getting these impressions, and then you use your mind, namely your ability to reflect and assent to those impressions. And then the output of your assent is going to motivate actions, form beliefs, desires, and so on. So
yeah.
Go ahead if you want to add any to that picture.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that that's important to keep that in mind, right? In the Stoic psychology, in the Stoic framework, you're always set with an impression, right? And then you can say, you can kind of nod your head, you can assent to that impression, right? Or not, right? An impression entails a proposition, right? There's a certain claim about the world that an impression is supposed to be making. Mm-hmm. The example I often use in class is, you know, don't think about pink elephants. It turns out it's very difficult once you say that to not think about pink elephants. But what you can do is if there's a notion that there are such things in the world as pink elephants, you don't have to assent to that, right? Even if you have a picture in your mind, right? Whether impressions or pictures, best thought of as pictures, but they're definitely claims and we can either assent to them or not. I think another thing that's really important when you're thinking about the Stoicism, and I think what makes Stoicism distinct is that the strength of the assent that matters. If I would say family is more important than money, in the abstract case where you say, which do you think is more important? It's very easy to do that and to assent that family is important, more important than money. In the very real case in which I'm given offered a great deal of money and it's going to put me at odds with my family, it might be harder to assent to that impression. And that's part of what makes the Stoic framework, I think, so distinct and important is they don't think of knowledge or beliefs as things that are atomic and completely context independent. Rather, knowing that virtue is good and vice is evil and all else is indifferent, it's how many different contexts. When the philosopher's lexicon, they would say a counterfactual robustness, right? How many different possible situations would you still believe that to be true? Would you still assent to that impression? I think that's an important bit to say as well. I think that's important to keep in mind when we start thinking about the limits of the mind-body issue. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of this idea that you can have stronger or weaker beliefs that are the output basically of patterns of assent, patterns of reflection. Is something the Stoics use to explain things like weakness of will, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
But so then I guess we have this idea, of course, you know, what I call the influence thesis, the non-mental world, the body influences and shapes our minds. And you can see how this would work in the sense that, of course, our bodies are going to play a role in what impressions we receive. And they're also going to play a role in how we reflect on the world, you know, what we bring to bear when we're reflecting on these impressions. And all of that is going to shape how we assent to impressions or not. That doesn't mean they're determining them, but on this weaker idea, the Stoics might say, and this is why, you know, you'll get some practical advice about, you know, ensuring that your body is healthy enough so that you can reflect on the world accurately, and so on. So I think that's that at the minimum, of course, the Stoics are going to say, look, your body's going to shape your mind because it's part of your ways in which you engage with the world. We are embodied creatures.
Certainly, yeah. And the idea that we're creatures that go through death and decay, right, and change from Heraclitus, they're going to get that's important. I think Marcus Aurelius, more than anyone, kind of focuses on these notions of we should keep our bodies, we should worry about them, right? You know, he says in book 5, number 33, nothing belongs to you but your flesh and blood, right? That there's this idea that we should take care of our bodies. He says in book 7, number 60, what the body needs is stability. So there is this idea that we should worry about that influence. And I certainly don't think that the Stoics it would be really counterintuitive if they didn't think that there could be some influence, and probably were lots of influences. You might think that's precisely why the Stoics have all of these reminders and preparations, is because they do recognize that there are going to be these influences, both societal and bodily influences, and that we ought to prepare ourselves when times are calm or stiller at the beginning of the day. We ought to remind ourselves that these things will happen. And so certainly the influence is something that I think the Stoics recognize, and precisely that's why we have all the preparations, right? Is precisely because we recognize the limitations of our physical form and our social natures.
Right. And I suppose we can't say that the Stoics recognize that we are embodied. You know, they think they were materialists. So they thought the mind ultimately is embodied in some aspect of us. Perhaps the ancient Stoics thought that was, you know, somewhere in our chest, maybe had something to do with the breath or something of this sort. But whatever those details, I think they'd be happy to update the philosophy
certainly.
You know, about the question, where exactly is the mind embodied?
Yeah.
I think that before we move on to some of these other versions of the thesis, make the problem a little bit sharper, something that just came to mind is that, of course, Epictetus says in the handbook, you know, think about what's up to you, what's your own, and one of those things that is not your own is the body. And I think that's that reminder that so much of our internal impressions are not up to us. Our bodies themselves are not directly under our control. They're not things we select. They will succeed or fail as fate has it. That's always
absolutely
a good reminder.
And those are things that the will itself will assent to or not, right? As a harm, right? So certainly at the Naval Academy, the quote that we refer to most frequently is lameness is an impediment of the leg, but not the will. And remind yourself of this with respect to everything. In large part, that is because that quote is etched on the base of the statue of Admiral Stockdale, who probably one of the more famous proponents of Stoicism in the 20th century. And what he was famously lame after ejecting from his plane during the Vietnam War, and when he crashed to the ground and he never got proper medical treatment. So he walked with a limp for the rest of his life. The first time I actually taught a Stoicism class at the Naval Academy, 66% of the class had ACL surgery that semester. So that was also our unofficial motto that semester. So absolutely, that's helpful to point out that while we're talking about this influence, we do need to recognize that the Stoics would very clearly say that the part of you that assents or doesn't to whether something is, let's say, a harm or has value is taken to be in some ways independent of the body. Yes. We don't need to get into the distinctions of kind of property dualism to say it's dependent upon but distinct from the body, I think is probably captures, I think, what the Stoics had in mind.
Right. Yeah. So I think there's a whole sort of conversation about, you know, what's the practical upshot about this influence idea? How do Stoics manage it? But I think something that we want to get onto tackle here is how can you make this problem perhaps even sharper for the Stoics? And something I think that I've been asked before is just this question about independence. So you have this famous line, usually a paraphrase of Viktor Frankl, that I think captures the Stoic attitude well. You know, you have between stimulus and response, there's a pause. And in that pause is where we find our freedom. And I think that maps onto the Stoic philosophy pretty well. But there's this question, you know, do you always have that pause? You always have the ability to respond. And here's where we have an idea. You could call it the independence thesis. You know, the ability to assent to an impression is not dictated or determined by the body. And this is perhaps something that many would argue is a thesis that we now know is mistaken. And if that's true, there's a question, you know, what does Stoicism amount to then? What's the practical import for Stoics today? But do you want to say more about that problem?
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I mean, one of my favorite Frankl quotes that captures that same kind of difference is that everything can be taken from a man, but one thing, the last of human freedoms, right? The ability to choose one's attitude in a given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way, right? And the Stoics do seem to have that idea that you always have that choice to assent or not, to say that I've been harmed or not. And perhaps if we think that there isn't this complete independence from the body and the mind, right? Our body can influence our ability to do that in, let's say, sometimes, then that's kind of, that starts to get to some of the problem. I mean, the first thing I like to point out as I'm walking through what seems to me a little bit of a problem is to point out that it's actually probably less a problem than we think. You know, the limits are often to our ability to choose, right? When our body just gives out is probably farther than you think. One of the goals of all kind of military training, but particularly kind of extreme military training and special forces, is to point out that you can hang on and do much more than you probably think you can. I think anyone that's gone through basic training would say, yeah, I could go further than I thought. The modern kind of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is becoming more and more kind of important, is in many ways based on a similar kind of idea that we can change our behavior in much more radical ways, even in kind of very ingrained patterns, right? So long as we do it in a way that follows a certain procedure, right? Our bodies actually don't make all of our decisions for us, even when we have very ingrained kinds of issues. One of the kind of most extreme cases of this, sometimes I worry about putting too much stock in it because it isn't a fully scientific study. It was just meant to be more like a one of kind of an interesting kind of aspect. And that was, they took a small group of people, 8 men in their 70s in 1981. And it was a psychologist named Ellen Langer. And she just made them for a couple of weeks act as if they were much younger. So she took out all the mirrors. So they were reminiscing about earlier eras. They played Ed Sullivan on the TV, right? They only played the Beatles. That's all they could do. You know, they talked about Johnny Unitas and Will Chamberlain, right, as current events at the table each night. And what's fascinating is after a few weeks of this, you know, they showed greater mental dexterity. They sat taller, right? And the weirdest one of all is that their sight actually improved. And that seems, you know, kind of odd to me. But it turns out that, I mean, it wasn't like they didn't have to wear glasses anymore, but their sight had actually improved over a couple of weeks of acting this way. So I think that we should recognize that the limits of this influence are actually probably farther than we often think. But certainly they exist. And I think we know that. And I think I think Stockdale actually offers us perhaps the greatest notion of that when he says, like, I recognized how useful the Stoics were, but I recognized that they were limitations. And so he has one of my favorite quotes in his book, Reflections of a Philosophical Fighter Pilot, where he talks about when you feel yourself sinking into a funk, right? When you feel like you're no good, when you feel like you're responsible for all of this, you have to force yourself to acknowledge the reality of your current situation, right? That you were tortured. And he means, actually, he's talking here about people who did things, who said things that they didn't want to say, right? People who voluntarily took on torture rather than do certain activities, mm-hmm. right? He found that they would break at some point, right? That they all would break, that there was no one in there that never broke after physical torture. There is a point at which the mind just can't hang on and you will do lots of different things to make the pain stop. But he says, you must recognize as well the truth that can also be exaggerated into fantasy and followed off another cliff. When you cite denying any personal responsibility, you're on the opposite mudslide to self-destruction. In that case, you know in your heart of hearts, you could have done better, that there is no magic point when you are suddenly transformed from a person of free will to a blameless victim of outside forces. Would that life were so simple. And so I think the real upshot of this is the Stoics don't need to deny this idea that at some point, that kind of space that Frankl was talking about, where you can choose, might be taken away because of impacts on your body. But that space is probably pretty far. And even in that case, so long as there's some sort of choosing going on, then there's something that you can strive to do better at, right? Unless it is literally using you mechanistically, right? The way we would if, you know, I put someone's head in front of your foot and hit the end of your knee, like the doctor does check your reflexes, right? And so maybe there is a point at which you can do that with your brain, right? Neuroscience is developing. There may be certain things we can do. And if we can do that, we literally can treat you objectively and take out any choice. Then there's probably nothing that we can say, but there's also probably nothing we can say about your moral responsibility or having to do better, right? I think what makes Stoicism interesting in a modern sense, once you accept this, is that you then have to start asking, well, okay, well, even then, right, in all these cases where it's short of this, I still might be able to do better. And there's still, and there might actually be a place for a kind of Stoic ideal still, right? That I should still hang on and do better, that I should still do these, try to do the best that I can. It does maybe mean that we have to give up on the possibility of a Stoic sage. It definitely means that we have to give up on the stability of a Stoic sage. So even a sage would have to worry about losing their faculties and remaining perfect, or having their body manipulated in such a way that they would no longer make all their decisions perfectly. But I think if we get back to Becker's original kind of charge, that still seems something distinctly Stoic to me. I think it allows you to, I think it's actually a more interesting picture because it's not a simple all or nothing. You can always choose it, mm-hmm. right? If I think about things like great pain or rewiring your brain through some sort of addiction, I think that what we need to recognize is actually that much as Stockdale said, would that life were so simple, right? Absolutely, we should probably treat those issues as medical conditions, not failures of determination or grit or resilience. But at the same point, we ought to recognize that that there is still choices involved, right? And that we need to specifically recognize that, or we will fail to treat the person fully. If I act badly out of great pain, and you just cure my pain, and you don't talk to me about how to make amends for the way I behaved badly, or at least if I don't go to the people that I wronged and give them the opportunity to forgive me, then I'm probably not helping me in the way that I need to be helped. And so that, I think, what's at stake here is that it brings in this complexity that I think actually makes the philosophy more interesting rather than less, and more tenable rather than less.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I think it's almost looking to me like this is more of a practical problem than a philosophical one, but let me see. I'm not sure if you'll agree yet. So we start with this idea. We have this independent thesis: the ability to assent to an impression isn't dictated or determined by the body, which initially looks like a problem. But then there's also this point, well, the Stoics are a determinist generally. So why would they, and they have their solutions to that problem. So why would they care whether you're determined by the body or something external? What matters is that, you know, you take in Epictetus's language, responsibility, or what's your own, your ability to reflect, assent. And they agree that, you know, sometimes the sage, they're going to be overpowered by impressions, or they're going to react in a certain way. There's that famous story about the sage who felt fright, that immediate
seasick.
A reaction when they thought their ship was about to sink. And then people poke at him and say, you know, you're so much for being a stoic. And he says, this is just like a input output type response. So maybe this is not exactly, I'm curious if you agree with this claim. Like, it seems like maybe the core problem is captured in your story of Stockdale. It's really, how much can you transform yourself? Or is there just going to be a limit set by the body or the world?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question about whether it's a practical problem or a philosophical one. Probably more practical than philosophical, but I would take it to be philosophical in the sense that it does change what we think of in terms of a sage. So the famous story about fear or seasickness and how what the sage felt was a proto-emotion, right? Mm-hmm. So he was given the impression that death would be a harm, or he was presented with an impression that to be lost at sea would be something that would be disvaluable, but didn't actually assent to it, right? Was just presented with the impression, right? Everyone's going to be presented with an impression. The example I often give my students is, if someone puts an axe in your back, even the sage is going to momentarily be presented with the impression that what has happened to them is a harm, right? Mm-hmm. Or is wrong, or is disvalue, or is to be more than merely dispreferred, right? Is wrong and harmful and losing something of value. I think that the mind-body problem does at least push back a little bit on that. And it does say that perhaps that even the assent can be problematic, right? That even the assent might be controlled in a certain way. If I know that there are ways that I can externally modify the way that you form beliefs or think about value by manipulating your body, then that might start to seem like more of a philosophical problem. Now, perhaps in the real world, those kinds of extreme cases aren't likely. Or, you know, even Stockdale is a pretty extreme case, right? And even military training for many people is a pretty extreme case, the kinds of cases that they'll go through. But severe pain is not. Most of us at some point in our life are going to experience pretty significant pain in a way that doesn't just present you with the impression, but may well not just make it harder, but may at some point make it impossible to assent to certain impressions about this not being a harm. And so in some ways it's not that different, because as we say, none of us are sages here, right? Even those that think that the sage is possible, Seneca said famously, a sage is as frequent as a phoenix. If we think that phoenixes actually never occur, which I think most of us do, then maybe that isn't such a big change. But it does make us, it would change the way we think about our bodies, especially with more of us living into ages in which our mental capacities are severely degraded. And it does make us think more about the kinds of protections we might need to have for ourselves, both physical and emotional, and frankly, character kinds of things. I might view my problematic thoughts about my those who live near me more significantly if I recognize there may be a point at which I won't have the same kind of filter, right? Mm-hmm. So I might think that those kinds of beliefs about my neighbor who always encroaches on my yard are even worse, right? They're already bad. I shouldn't have them. They're unvirtuous. they're placing value on things that they aren't. But if I recognize there'll come a point at which I'm not just merely mildly troubled inside and able to quickly calm myself and not say anything to my neighbor, that I will just spout off. That might also change my attitudes about now. So is it practical? Is it philosophical? I mean, it is still, I think, and we haven't talked yet about your myth thesis.
Sure, sure.
But I think it is philosophical in that sense. And I think it's philosophical in the sense of whether the sage is a possibility that's really, really hard and we're determinists and maybe I'm never going to be a sage, or whether the sage is actually an asymptotic ideal that no one's met, not Socrates, not Cato, and they just came much closer. I think that that's a distinction. And if I have to worry about my body in the future, in part because I recognize not only that these things might make my ascent more or less likely, but might not make it possible, that might also make both a practical and a philosophical difference. I don't know if that answers the question, but I think it's a good question. It's probably more practical than philosophical.
No, yeah, I suppose to say that it's a philosophical or theoretical problem, I think you did have, at least Diogenes Laertius, I think, reports that there's this debate between the Cleanthes and Chrysippus. And Chrysippus held the view that, if I my notes about from Graver are correct, held the view that virtue can, in fact, be lost, either in cases of severe, what they would call melancholia, which we would probably label as a severe mental disorder, or drunkenness. And then the thought, but Cleanthes did not think this was so. And Cleanthes is generally considered to be closer to the traditional Stoic view, if you will, on this picture.
So. Yeah, I will have to go back and look at that. Yeah, so I mean, part of the issue here too, so maybe this is part of it, how much it's a philosophical view. So we often act as if there is a canonical view. But as you point out, right, especially when you're talking about the interesting thing about the debate between Cleanthes and Chrysippus is they were both heads of the school, right? So it's not merely like Aristo that became kind of a heretical view, right? And that the Stoics kind of moved past and isn't considered a paradigmatic Stoic view. But both of them were able to speak for the school. So even though there was one school in Athens, there were different heads, and obviously the view change from Zeno to Cleanthes to Chrysippus, right, to further heads. It got modified based on what seemed reasonable, the way it was pushed by other theories. And of course, by the time you get to Roman Stoicism, there's no even central figure. And so saying that there's a distinctive Stoic view is perhaps a mistake. And maybe I'm falling into that too, right? But I think perhaps one of the things the mind-body problem can do is maybe settle those disputes in a way, or at least perhaps make one of them much more likely or much more in line with what we think about the way that the mind and body interact based on the best science of today, right? Mm-hmm. And so maybe we wouldn't continue to have that debate about whether or not you could lose virtue. Maybe we just have to say, yeah, you can lose virtue, right? But that's a good point. I really like that. That's nice.
Yeah, I suppose the way that Chrysippus thought this would happen is essentially, and he would say that in these cases, the sage would stop becoming a rational agent. That's because of the extent of their condition. So in that sense, they could lose
their virtue. Sure. I mean, so the easy case is anyone in a persisted vegetative state could lose their virtue, but they are not making any choices anymore. Okay. What severe mental degradation does is it pushes us into recognizing, as Stockdale says, that it isn't just a simple, there isn't a simple off switch from fully virtuous, fully rational human being to not making any choices anymore. And in fact, one of the things I find fascinating in bioethics, kind of tied to that, is a recognition that we shouldn't treat patients as competent all in or not, that we should recognize that they may still well have all kinds of ability to make choices about their day and their life and what kind of physical therapy they would prefer, even if they don't lack the mental capacity to make all of their mental decisions, for example. And while legally that can be problematic, you're either transferring that power to another agent or not, it's all in, you can still operate as if that person has the kind of ability to make all kinds of choices. So a philosopher named Brock makes that case in a book called Deciding for Others, which I think is true. It's one of the ways that we think about that kind of loss of agency, that it isn't all or nothing. It's the same thing with kids, with gaining agency, right? It isn't all or nothing. The same thing maybe for all of us at all stages in our lives.
Right, right. Yeah, I suppose that then that brings our attention back to the practical questions that you mentioned.
Yeah,
you know, how do you handle those cases where you think you'll be in a middle condition, as it were? You
know, yeah.
Less rational, less function.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else you want to say about the independence thesis?
I don't think there's anything else I want to say about the independence thesis. I think Do we want to move on and talk a little bit about the myth, which I really like?
Yeah,
your thoughts on the myth.
So one other potential problem that I've been thinking through for some time is, yeah, I've called here the myth thesis. There's no deep separation between our mind and body. The ways of thought that put up a barrier between the two take us away from reality in some way. And I think you can see this in the work of this fellow named Matthew Crawford, a modern philosopher. Some Buddhist thinkers seem to have this kind of view. And then there are a few different thinkers, maybe in the continental tradition. You have Martin Heidegger and then some direct realists who think this distinction between mind and body is an illusion, and perhaps worse than mere fanciful illusion, in some way takes us away from the real world. And to try and make this more relevant for the Stoics have this view that, you know, your mind is always being presented with impressions and you're always managing impressions instead of, and this might be the argument you'd get from someone like Matthew Crawford, instead of directly engaging with the world in a tactile way, almost a non-propositional way, the kind of way in which you think about the world in a more intuitive physical sense. Probably you can think about athletes or crafts, people practicing their craft, just interact with the world, not thinking so much thinking about, I do something, there's an impression, is this impression true or not, should I assent to it, and then moving on, which almost suggests like that you can interact with the world like it's a computer, like, you know, you're just presented with these different icons that represent parts of the world and you interact with those icons, but never directly make contact with it. So I suppose there are two parts of the myth thesis. First, that there is no deep separation between ourselves and the world. You can engage with it directly, but also these ways of thought, perhaps Stoicism, can make it, you know, they're mythical in a sense, and that's bad. They can take us away from directly interacting with the world and thinking too much at the verbal level, at the analytical level, or what have you.
Yeah, I think there's something really to that. And I think what it does is, and this is a really philosophical, deep issue, because it points to one of the central differences between Stoicism and Buddhism. So the way I often frame it is that the Stoics are trying to eliminate all desires beyond things within my control, that is, for my own virtue and choosing well. And the Buddhists want to do away with all desires at all, including that. In fact, in the Buddhist framework, the last desire is often the desire for enlightenment, right? One of the quotes from one of the most famous sutras is right before the Buddha reaches enlightenment. He says, this is a good place to sit for a striver intent on striving, right? That it's all about he's trying to become this thing, and it is only when he gives away that striving that he can reach enlightenment itself. And that seems that seems true to me, and that seems a real challenge. And I can see why that would push some people towards the Buddhist path. I will say for myself personally, I love Crawford's work, particularly, you know, Shop Class of Soulcraft, where he talks about how we engage with the world, the way we need to do this. And there probably aren't that many places where I need to assent or not. And we as philosophers, and particularly philosophers educated and trained in the Western tradition coming from Greece and Athens, have probably been corrupted in ways that the Stoics would caution against, right? Focusing so much on propositional knowledge, focusing so much on knowledge of particular facts, and thinking that that's what's going on. I still think that there can be places where we really do need to either assent or not. And it really is the way that we interact with the world is through acting on what has value and deciding what has value, what matters, what is meaningful, if we want to get back to Frankl.
Yeah.
The Stoics would talk less about meaning, but they would certainly talk about harms and values. And I think that they would say that those are the places where these kinds of ascents are the most important. Precisely why, getting back to what I said at the beginning about the strength of the ascent, precisely why that matters is because these are the kinds of things that are very easy to say and assent to in the calmness of the classroom. That you ought not care about money, reputation, and power, but rather care about the state of your soul and the kind of person that you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Socrates has that famous bit in the Apology where he says, you know, you, sir, are an Athenian, a citizen, the greatest and mightiest city in the world. Are you not ashamed that you care so much about accumulating money, honors, and reputation with so little concern about wisdom, truth, and the improvement of your soul, right? It's very easy, especially, you know, when we're idealistic young people protected in a college environment, to be like, yes, obviously that's what matters, right? That's the kind of person I want to be. But how we act in different situations demonstrates whether we are actually affirming that value or not. And I certainly don't affirm that value all the time. I don't know anyone that does. But I think that in those cases is where the Stoic picture makes more sense, right? In kind of the everyday crafting the world, right? Engaging with the world, building things, taking things, right? Viewing things differently even. Maybe kind of an overly intellectual, even viewing it as having propositional content at all, right? When I'm walking along the beach and thinking that I'm being presented with propositions might be a really alienating way to experience the world. There are at least some claims about what has value, what doesn't, what matters and what doesn't, what can harm us and what doesn't. And I think those are the ones that where the Stoic framework and picture matters so much. So there might be actually very few things that we can know in the Stoic framework.
Okay.
And the Stoics would say we only know things when we assent to that impression in all possible situations. So it might only be that virtue is good and vice is evil and all else is indifferent, right? It might only be, you know, things like justice more than money, right? There might only be a small handful of claims we can make. It's really then about the practical problem. And they might even be so obvious in general that everybody would agree to them, right? Without even much debate, right? Justice matters more than money, all things being equal,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, then how does that apply to this case? Well, then we might have lots of fights and such things like that. But it's really about being able to endorse that in all cases, right? Even when there's a great deal of money for me and a small bit of injustice for someone else on the line, that matters. And so I think that is a real challenge for Stoicism. I think it's worth thinking about a lot. I can see why some people are going to say, Yeah. And that's why I'm a Buddhist or a Taoist. Might be Crawford, might be more in the Taoist camp.
Right, right.
But I think there's probably some subset of value where there is something propositional underneath, and our actions do demonstrate how we endorse what has value and what has meaning and what is virtuous.
Right. Yeah. There's a sense in which the Stoics do agree there's no deep separation between the mind and body. The mind is embodied, and they just think the mind is so much larger than some other philosophers would have it. It's involved in emotion. It's involved in actions. Our decisions themselves are endorsements of propositions.
Yeah. So maybe that's a good point, Caleb. Maybe that's a point where I might be more willing to question, because they think all of our actions are based on impulses, which mm-hmm. are based on a same kind of when I reach the example Ted Brandon gives is when I reach for the coffee cup, it's based on a belief that there's coffee in the cup and that I want coffee, and that the impulse, the actual move, is based on those two propositional contents and acknowledging them even when I'm not aware of it. And maybe there's a lot of action in the world that isn't of that form.
Right.
Yeah, I have to think more about that. That the idea that all of our actions is based on impulses, which are a kind of belief, is something maybe I'm less comfortable with. And maybe it's why I push to these things that really seem belief driven and really seem ethical for the Stoic framework, because that's where it seems to have a lot more cachet. That's a really interesting question about whether all actions have that same sort of duality and involve our mind in any way. Sometimes they might just well be embodied in a much deeper way.
Right. Yeah. So I think maybe that suggests that a potential modification or a clarification of Stoicism would be to allow impressions that are not these verbal analytic type things and ways of thinking, ways of thought that are not necessarily, sometimes it's called left brain, literally involving literal thought, literal representation and so on. But
Sure.
Making that
and it might be, and part of that too, and I have to think more about this. I mean, here I'll just admit to my own limitation in knowledge of the Stoics in terms of their logic and as much in their psychology about whether it's propositional in the sense that in which all beliefs and actions are propositional in the sense in which, let's say, 20th century philosophers view it to be propositional, because that does start to seem to be a bit much. But I just don't know enough about if they would somehow parse that slightly differently. That while it might not actually be propositional, it could be expressed propositionally or something like this.
Right.
That even though I'm not acting on those beliefs, you know, we could express your actions via those beliefs, right? He must believe that there's coffee in the cup and have some sort of desire for coffee. But even there, I think that like those kind of examples push that a little bit, because there are certainly times when I know for certain, well, not in a Stoic sense, but it seems like I know that there isn't any liquid in the cup because I just reached for it a few minutes ago. And there's certainly times when I reach, even when I don't have a desire anymore, and it's just purely out of, I don't know, I'm taking a breath, or the cup is there. It's an affordance of some kind. And so there probably are some limitations in the Stoic philosophy of action that might be worth thinking about.
Yeah, my impression is that Stoics are generally very explicit. You know, you have terms that signify, there's something signified, and that's signified via the lecta, right? And that lecta is generally interpreted as a propositional matter, which is why they thought animals weren't rational and so on, because they didn't have
that
were necessarily for.
Makes sense, right? Given the idea that 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 kind of abstraction is going to be necessary for both their logic and their thinking of what makes us distinctly rational and what makes us distinctly able to value in the same way. Yeah. Yeah. That's worth, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's maybe some interesting, an interesting suggestion around whether lecta need to be propositional or not, or if you can have conceptual content without language. And there's this sorts of debate, which might, I think could rescue parts of the Stoic picture. But
yeah, I think that's another distinction though. Yeah. So how much of that, I'm just playing out in my own mind. Yeah. How much are those two problems related? Right. So how much is our embodied nature and kind of maybe that this kind of distinction between the mind and body is not as significant as maybe the Stoics would make, and how much of the idea that what's really going on is deeply propositional, how much are those influence each other? It doesn't surprise me that they go together, right? Especially given all the other things the Stoics say about reason, about what makes us who we are, about animals. But I'm not sure if they how linked they are.
Got it.
That's an interesting question too.
Yeah, yeah. Because you could think I grab the coffee cup. It's not doesn't have anything to do with perception as such, rather at least not understood in this propositional or perhaps non-conceptual type way, but instead have to do with desires, reflexes in a particular way, a kind of embodied life. Yeah. That's just not captured by Stoicism yet.
Yeah, because I see it as a thing to be drunk from, right? Almost like I see the world more like Alice in Wonderland. You're right. You know, it's just I see the world with certain kinds of like at the very least suggestions, right? Grab me. I see stone. I mean, I'm a Midwest kid, so I see certain stones that call out to be skipped.
Right.
And not all stones, very specific subset of stones that are whose telos is skipping. Right. Yeah. There's a very certain subset of bull mascot that is meant to be eaten. Not most of them, but anyway.
Nice. Yeah, I think from the comment about the focus, especially on values and that needing to be the kind of thing where you reflect on them, assent to them or not, thinking about what harms you, what benefits you, is an important one. I think important, or sort of both philosophical, yeah, theoretical, yeah, and practical response to this idea of the myth. Whether or not it ultimately ends up being a myth, that's where the focus ought to lie. I think
that's at least the highest ground on which to defend it, right? This idea that, you know, as Cicero says, I have to decide what kind of life I want to lead, what kind of person I want to be. That turns out to be the most difficult question of all, right? And so, if those kinds of questions about the kind of person I want to be, what the kind of life I lead, what I think has value, about what I want to devote my heart beats to, what I want to sacrifice for. Those are things that seem to require the kind of reflection and the kind of endorsement that makes the picture make much more sense than kind of everyday action. And those are the kinds of things where I personally will hold out for the Stoic view over the Buddhist view, that there is something valuable in deciding well about what has value, in deciding well about what we ought to prioritize.
Excellent. Well, I think that's a good spot to end. Thanks for coming right again, Marcus.
Oh, thanks, Caleb. It's great as always. And I learn a lot from these and they're always fascinating to reflect on. So thanks.
Thanks for listening to Stoic Conversations. Please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and share it with a friend. If you want to dive deeper still, search Stoa in the App Store or Play Store for a complete app with routines, meditations, and lessons designed to help people become more Stoic. And I'd also like to thank Michael Levy for graciously letting us use his music. You can find more of his work at ancientlyre.com. And finally, please get in touch with us. Send a message to stoa@stoameditation.com if you ever have any feedback, questions, or recommendations. Until next time.